I read that paragraph last week, and then you said that we were going to talk about it, and that it was like a book in itself, that long.
Yeah, that's the one.
I'd be glad to read it again.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay. But the immortality or eternity of the soul does not at once impose itself, even if we reject the explanation of all things by eternal matter. For we have also the hypothesis of the creation of a temporary or apparent soul by some power of the original unity from which all things began, by which they live, and into which they cease. On one side, we can erect upon the foundation of certain modern ideas or discoveries the theory of a cosmic inconscient creating a temporary soul, a consciousness which, after a brief play, is extinguished and goes back into the inconscient. Or there may be eternal becoming, which manifests itself in a cosmic life force with the appearance of matter as one objective end of its operations, and the appearance of mind as the other subjective end. The interaction of these two phenomena of life force creating our human existence. On the other side, we have the old theory of a soul existing superconscient, an eternal, unmodifiable being, which admits or creates by Maya an illusion of individual soul life in this world of phenomenal mind and matter, both of them ultimately unreal, even if they have or assume a temporary and phenomenal reality. Since one unmodifiable and eternal self or spirit is the only entity. Or we have the Buddhist theory of a nihil or nirvana, and somehow imposed upon that an eternal action or energy of successive becoming, karma, which creates the illusion of a persistent self or soul by a constant continuity of associations, ideas, memories, sensations, images. In their effect upon the life problem, all these three explanations are practically one. For even the superconscient is for the purposes of the universal action the equivalent of the inconscient. It can be aware only of its own unmodifiable self-existence. The creation of a world of individual beings by Maya is an imposition on this self-existence. It takes place, perhaps, in a sort of self-absorbed sleep of consciousness, sushupati, out of which yet all active consciousness in modification of phenomenal becoming emerge. Just as in the modern theory, our consciousness is an impermanent development out of the inconscient. In all three theories, the apparent soul, a spiritual individuality of the creature, is not immortal in the sense of eternity, but has a beginning and an end in time. Is the creation by Maya or by nature force a cosmic action out of the inconscient or superconscient, and is therefore impermanent in its existence? In all three, rebirth is either unnecessary or else illusory. It is either the prolongation by repetition of an illusion, or it is an additional revolving wheel among the many wheels of the complex machinery of the becoming. Or it is excluded, since a single birth is all that can be asked for by a conscious being fortuitously engendered as part of an inconscient creation.
So, to step back for a moment before considering what he is proposing over here, and sum up the main idea that he has provided before this. Sri Aurobindo start with trying to give us the theories of the soul, that is there something within us which is the essence or entity that is the core of our personality? And what is the temporality of this something? Is it something which appears and disappears with the body? Is it something which appears with the body and never disappears? Is it something that never appears and never disappears, or never begins and never ends? And even if it never begins and never ends, is it something which has a kind of sort of absorption in some sort, some kind of substance? In other words, is it reducible to some principle out of which it arises and into which it dissolves? So initially he takes up the inconscient theory, that is the one which believes that we have no soul, that soul is some kind of a epiphenomenon of matter and its mutations. And he goes through his own reasoning to show that to deny independent existence to life and mind is not in consonance with our deepest intuitions, because matter itself cannot be explained in its own terms. It needs to be explained in terms of laws, rules, upheld more or less by the principle of life and beneath it by the principle of mind. Therefore, consciousness cannot be thought of as being dependent on matter. Then he goes on to talk about the persistence of this, but the conscious part in each person, that if we think of that conscious part, then we have to look at, if it has an independent reality, we have to look at what kind of reality or what kind of temporality that has. In turn, he looks towards the various religions that have talked about this. So he picks on first what we know as the Judeo-Christian traditions. According to the Abrahamic religions, man has a soul, but that soul comes into its beginning with the body. That is, with birth, each soul has a new beginning. But these souls don't have an end with the death. In other words, after death, the soul goes into some kind of realm, depending on what it has sort of done. And there are some variations on this theory. But essentially, it goes into a latency and awaits the day of judgment. And after the judgment takes place, it goes either to an eternal hell or to an eternal heaven. So here there is the eternity of a soul, and that eternity is waiting upon the judgment of God, which is a temporal event. And after that, it remains forever. Now, he points out that there is a problem with this entire theory. And firstly, before that, he points out that to the persistence of this consciousness within us, our experiences at birth and our experiences at death are the evidence or are the verification. And we were talking about this a little bit earlier, this development of the already developed consciousness at birth. So there are some ways by which, you know, each individual has certain kinds of, one may say, you know, sort of learnings that are intrinsic to it, even during childhood. There are leaps, as it were. It isn't as if the faculties of nature are enough to justify these leaps of consciousness during childhood. This is the point he's making. But we may also think about the exceptional cases progress, cases which, you know, have to be taken into account, we just cannot dismiss them because they don't fit into our theory. And these cases include such cases as child prodigies, people who during childhood suddenly wake up to entire, complex understandings that they never had before, and also people who can remember past births at childhood. Now, these are very, may not be the run-of-the-mill kind of experience, but nevertheless, they attest to the existence of consciousness before any particular life, a particular life. And similarly, he points to the fact of the unfinished nature of consciousness at death. The body falls, but there is a certain kind of development of consciousness which, given the independence of consciousness as life or mind, presumes that there is some kind of a continuity that may occur after the fall of the body. Now, this far we can arrive at contesting the Judeo-Christian theories, the Abrahamic religions, and say that if there is, and that's the last paragraph before what was read today, if there is a birth of consciousness, then there must be a death of consciousness. And if there is no death of consciousness, then there cannot be a birth of consciousness either. This is the argument that he takes up there at the end of that particular paragraph. And then he moves on to this present paragraph, and here he's asking the question as to whether if there is some kind of consciousness which appears, whether in past lives or in the present life, and which disappears, irrespective of whether it is in this life or in a future life, could it not be that this consciousness is reducible to some other principle? And here he proposes three kinds of such universal principles. One is the inconscient. The second is the consciousness that we experience, the universal consciousness, you may say, of life, operating or manifesting between two poles, the pole of mind and the pole of matter. And the third is of a super conscience. And then to that he gives a variation, which is the Buddhistic variation. It is a super conscient nihil, or a super conscient unmanifest. So in all these cases, the question is, can we think about the soul as a illusion? If consciousness is an epiphenomenon of matter, then we can think about the soul as an illusion of inconscience, or a phenomenon of inconscience, which will eventually, irrespective of how many lives, be reabsorbed into inconscience. So too, in the case of life, and we can think about philosophers like Henri Bergson and the Elan Vital, which is a creative energy that is manifesting in forms. And this creative energy is universal. It doesn't have an individual reality. The individual reality is only a seeming that persists with the appearance of individual forms. So the Elan Vital, individualized into an appearance in this body, is so-called soul. After the body goes, this consciousness, this creative life energy, becomes absorbed into the universal vital. And finally, he's talking about the superconscience. And in this superconscience, we can think about Advaitic theories, theory of Keval Advaita, for example, of Shankara, where the soul is not really a kind of substantial reality, But the indivisible unity of Brahman, of Satchidananda, is made to dream up this innumerable multiplicity of consciousnesses by the action of Maya. Out of the action of Maya, from the superconscience, they arise, and back into the superconscience, they disappear at the end of the cycle of rebirths. That therefore becomes the goal of the darshan of Kevala Advaita Vedanta. Related to that is Buddhism, where there is the theory of a nihil or nirvana, and that is the reality, but there is no substantial reality of the soul. The soul is not even a substantial illusion. The soul is just an emptiness that the nature is making us feel exists. And nature is a sum of psychological formations kept in its persistence due to the power of desire. So a universal action of energy, as he's saying, or of some kind of Maya, is keeping the appearance of individuality alive on a backdrop of nothingness. Once these formations are made to stop, nothing remains. It is absorbed. We cannot even say it is absorbed because it never existed. All that happens is the emptiness which persists after all phenomena have passed. So these are the various reductionist theories that Sri Aurobindo is proposing to found the reality of the soul. Now, in all these kinds of theories, we may say that that there is really no necessity of positing rebirth. As he says, in all three, rebirth is either unnecessary or an illusion. It is either the prolongation by repetition of an illusion. So that is both in the case of Advaita and Buddhism. They accept the theory of reincarnation, but it has no real utility. It doesn't serve anything at all. It just happens to be a momentum of illusion. It is either prolongation by repetition of an illusion, or it is an additional revolving wheel among the many wheels of the complex machinery of the becoming. Or it is excluded, that is the inconscient theory. Since a single birth is all that can be asked for by a conscious being, fortuitously engendered as part of its inconscient creation. So he's pointing out that there's a close linkage between the eternal existence of the soul, the irreducibility of the soul, and the idea of rebirth. If there is to be rebirth, then it can only be that of something which is true and real. For otherwise, there is no need for rebirth. We don't need to posit a rebirth. It is theoretically unnecessary. Now, then also the question of this persistence of the soul. Is it then something which needs to be seen as eternal? And if it is so, then we have to say that it does not follow the rule of, it is somehow different from, radically different from, nature, because everything in nature is ultimately a change or mutation of formations which gets absorbed into some universal foundation. So if the soul, the individual soul, is not to be absorbed into a universal foundation, whether that of matter or life or mind or of the spirit, the superconscious, then what is it? What is its reality? There is only one way to explain such a reality. and that is that it is the Brahman itself. Each soul is the Brahman. The Brahman has the property of conceiving itself innumerably, and these innumerable self-conceptions don't beginning or an end. They are the Brahman. So that is the only way in which we can think about the soul as being not some part or portion of some other principle, but being truly eternal, being true, real, and eternal. And then we have to think about the notion of rebirth.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Thank you, Devashis, for your comments on that. That's a lot to think about. Thanks.
I think he will develop this further as we go along, so we'll see how he develops it. But at this point, this is... you know, it's a rather important philosophical question which impinges ultimately on our goals or aspirations towards what it is that we are trying to become. Because it's a very critical issue, ultimately that is going to determine how we define the human being. This very question about, you know, what is the basis of the soul.
Devashish, you mentioned, I think somewhere in there, the concept of creation. And I'm wondering, in this, the triple world, is there actually creation, or is it just an uncovering of consciousness that's there?
Well, that's a very, very profound question. And, you know, from a certain point of view, you know, what we're talking about as creation is a paradox. It cannot even exist because a beginning and a time is something that is not in consonance with eternity. So we have to think about creation, even if you think about it as an uncovering, as a repetition of beginnings and ends, appearance of beginnings and ends, which is an act of Maya. Maya can sort of transform, you may say, continuity into quantum. That is a way of speaking, but basically I'm using these terms not in terms of physics, but in terms of philosophy, that the eternal continuity can be sort of converted into a succession, unending succession of beginnings and ends. These are two ways of seeing the same thing. So if we talk about it in terms of unfolding or uncovering, that too may have to be looked at as a process which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that looking at, that way by which one conceives of reality as having a beginning, a middle, and an end is an act of Maya. So Maya can look at the same reality in innumerable ways. And this is one of those ways. It is the same, you know, super conscience or the same Brahman, the same Satchidananda, but objectified to itself. It can gaze upon itself as fully its own object. As soon as it does that, it sees that its own consciousness is completely latent within it. It presents the appearance of surface only. And that pure surface is what we call matter. But surface asks or begs the question of the contents which are within. And that becomes the whole exploration of unfoldment. So creation from that point of view is actually the same as unfoldment, but seen as an act of Maya.
I'll think about that. Thank you.
Louis, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Okay. In these views, whether we suppose the one eternal existence to be a vital becoming or immutable and unmodifiable spiritual being or a nameless and formless non-being, that which we call the soul can be only a changing mass or stream of phenomena of consciousness which has come into existence in the sea of real or illusionary becoming and will cease to exist there. Or it may be it is a temporary spiritual substratum, a conscious reflection of the superconscient eternal which by its presence supports the mass of phenomena. It is not eternal, and its only immortality is a greater or less continuity in the becoming. It is not a real and always existent person who maintains and experiences the stream or mass of phenomena. That which supports them, that which really and always exists, is either the one eternal becoming or the one eternal and impersonal being or the continual stream of energy in its workings. For a theory of this kind, it is not indispensable that a psychic entity, always the same, should persist and assume body after body, form after form, until it is dissolved at last by some process annulling altogether the original impetus which created this cycle. It is quite possible that as each form is developed, a consciousness develops corresponding to the form, and as the form dissolves, the corresponding consciousness dissolves with it. The one which forms all alone endures forever. Or as a body is gathered out of the general elements of matter, and begins its life with birth and ends with death, so the consciousness may be developed out of the general elements of mind and equally begin with birth and end with death. Here too, the one who supplies by Maya or otherwise the force which creates the elements is the sole reality that endures. In none of these theories of existence is rebirth an absolute necessity or an inevitable result of the theory.
So here he is really continuing the same thought or idea introduced in the previous paragraph, essentially what we have just discussed, which is that of the possibility of that consciousness that inhabits a body being something that is derived from a larger substratum of consciousness, a universal substratum, such as matter, universal life, or mind, or the superconscious. Now, he is elaborating that possibility over here in this paragraph and pointing to, once again, the fact that if that is the case, then there is really no need for rebirth. That consciousness can actually appear with a body and disappear with a body. Or if it appears with a body and doesn't disappear with a body, then it still can disappear with some other body. See, it is gathered out of the general elements of matter, or it is developed out of the general elements of mind, or, as he says, you know, just whatever there is as the one persists, whatever universal principle is the foundation, is all that persists, whatever consciousness appears doesn't need to be reborn. Yes.
Good question here. Does he mean to say that the philosophy of rebirth is neither explained by Advaita Vedanta or by Buddhism? Or it is not necessary for Advaita Vedanta or Buddhism to actually take into account the philosophy of rebirth?
Yeah, he's saying that both are actually corollaries of one another.
Mm-hmm.
That either Advaita Vedanta or Buddhism, doesn't need rebirth, in its scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And the other corollary would be that Advaita Vedanta and Buddhism. Kind of pay lip service to rebirth, but it is of no consequence to their theory. In other words, if the rebirth is true, Advaita Vedanta and Buddhism have no real, somewhere their basis doesn't explain it. And if their theory is true, then rebirth is unnecessary.
Because both of these philosophies, they do not talk about the psychic being, and it is the psychic being which is taking rebirth.
Yeah, exactly. What he calls temporal eternity.
Right.
Eternity in time of consciousness.
Uh-huh.
Beginningless and endless movement in time. So, quite right, that they don't have any, but in a sense, they don't even give reality to Jivatman except as an illusion. Even that which doesn't enter time, in the case of Buddhism, of course, doesn't exist. There is only Anatman. And
right.
In the case of Advaita Vedanta, it is a seeming illusion that persists from life to life or through lives, but is unchanging, and ultimately sort of is to dissolve itself in the truth, in the knowledge.
In fact, you know, interestingly, I just noticed that towards the end of that paragraph, there is a footnote, and within that footnote, you know, this is kind of explained.
Yeah, very true. I think that footnote should be read too.
That in the Buddhist theory, rebirth is imperative because karma compels it. Not a soul, but karma is the link of an apparently continuing consciousness. While the consciousness changes from moment to moment, there is this apparent continuity of consciousness, but there is no real immortal soul taking birth and passing through the death of the body to be reborn in another body.
Exactly.
I just know.
And in fact, yeah, exactly. And in fact, you see, they use the image of the candle, and the literal meaning of nirvana is, you know, what translates in parochial, kind of even in modern sort of vernaculars of India, we say nibbana. Nibbana is to turn off, to extinguish. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it sort of refers to the extinguishment of a candle flame, which is the image Buddha uses again and again, or at least the early texts use. We don't really know whether Buddha used, but the texts use. And the idea that is associated with it of consciousness is also highlighted in that they make it a point to explain the fact that a candle is not a enduring substantiality, but a succession of moments of burning of the wick. That it is the continuous burning of the wick that produces the appearance of something constant, which is the candle flame. And as soon as that appearance is put a stop to, nothing remains. So that is the insubstantiality of the appearance of the successions of movement of consciousness.
Doesn't Sri Aurobindo talk about there's something above the psychic being that's out of the evolution, but it's part of the psychic being?
Well, what it is, you know, what it is, Vince, is that actually, you know, the soul, the divine soul, the supreme being, the Brahman, is the divine soul. It is the Paramatman who conceives of itself innumerably. Therefore, it is infinite. It is outside of any creation, and it enters into any kind of creation that it wishes to enter into. Its status outside of the creation, outside of time and space, is the Jivatman. Its status as unformed essence within time and space is Antaratman. And its status as the soul personality that develops distinguishable form and evolves from life to life is the psychic being. So psychic being is only one aspect of this reality called soul.
So if you, you can identify with the, what was it, the para atman and the jiva atman by identifying the psychic being? Excuse me?
Yeah, you can do that too. I mean, there is a way by which definitely if the psychic being is backgrounded by the psychic entity and, you know, projected by the Jivatman, which itself is a self-conception of the Paramatman, you can travel back up the ladder and experience all these things through the psychic being, which is none other, in a sense, than one particular formulation of these things. Now, that, in a sense, is one way to understand the triple transformation. Why the psychic transformation is not the end of this yoga of Sri Aurobindo is because of that. in a sense.
Can I ask another question on his writing, but it's not to do with rebirth completely? He talks about the becoming or the being, and then he also says, or the continual stream of energy. Now, is the other form of being energy?
Yeah, the word energy he's using over here is to talk about the consciousness in time. So, being and becoming. So, you know, you talk about stream of energy or stream of consciousness. You're essentially talking about the temporal sort of side of the static eternal being, which is, in other words, becoming. So the two are, you know, two faces of the Brahman. That's why he talks about active and passive Brahman, passive Brahman and active Brahman.
But do forces have a being connected with them?
Yeah, undoubtedly.
Yeah, okay.
Undoubtedly.
No, that came up because I was thinking of that darshana concept and the meaning seeing.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, that's part of the reason why Sri Aurobindo, you know, doesn't talk merely about impersonal forces, whether it is at the very, you know, sort of elementary level of the forces that are at play in the universe. Psychological forces or universal, you know, quality forces of consciousness, or whether it is spiritual forces like chit shakti, you know, conscious force. These are not merely principles, are not merely forces, but they are also beings. To each one of them is associated a being, and they can be therefore addressed and controlled as beings as well. That is part
seen
of the occult reality of things, and seen as beings.
Right, if you're in that place.
Debashista, can you explain again what is the difference between the psychic being and the Antaratman?
The Antaratman is what I believe Sri Aurobindo and the mother have referred to as the psychic entity. Okay. The psychic entity is the soul essence inside of time and space, but it is unchanging. So just as the Jivatman is outside of time and space, like a kind of, self-appearance of the Supreme Being, that projects itself into the mutations of nature and evolving or the evolution of nature and remains at one level as a kind of a primordial substance, soul substance, that is the psychic entity or Antaratman. Antaratman is it's like eternally malleable psychic substance which can formulate itself in any way that it wishes. But being a specific self-conception of the divine, it formulates itself through certain kinds of nature forms in certain ways, progressing from life to life, and that self-formulation, that personality that it puts forward is the psychic being.
So even the Jivatman, you can say that every psychic being is attached to one particular Jivatman, right? Or is it just
yes.
One, the one that is?
No. Jivatman is already a self-multiplication of Paramatma. But the reality of Jivatman and the reality of Paramatman are not separated because it's a self-conception. This is happening in the higher hemisphere. It is what is known as the prajnana of supermind. In other words, it's one and many at the same time.
Okay, somebody has the microphone on, I think. Can you just check? Kundan, I think yours is on. Yeah. I mean, Kundan was saying his reception is really bad. For me, it's fine. Is there anyone who's seeing the reception to be really poor?
No, for me it's much better.
Okay.
Yeah, for me it's poor.
Oh, I see. Okay, so Kundan says that his is so bad he might have to leave.
It's yeah, not me, because I have a mute.
I cannot hear it properly, you know. The voice is breaking, and I'm not able to make much sense of it. It started off very well, and then later, progressively, it got worse.
Oh.
My apologies to everybody.
Okay. Debashita, I have a question on when Sri Aurobindo is talking about Buddhism here. Does he mean only the old Buddhism, the Sthaviravada? Because later Buddhism, they had this concept of not psychic being, but some entity called Bodhisattva entity.
But Bodhisattva is a universal being. It's an archetype. It's a transcendental archetype. And that really doesn't have psychic being. It's actually, you may say, a transcendental image. And so, yeah, there is a confusion over there. And later Mahayana really grapples with this problem of soul. How can it maintain the non-existence of the soul and yet talk about something which is substantial and has a form which enters into life and the cycle of rebirths? That becomes a big paradox in Buddhism. That's partly why Buddhism becomes so complicated as it goes along.
Mm-hmm.
Its theories, it branches into a number of, different theories, and it's very complicated trying to sort of split hairs about non-substantiality and some kind of transcendental reality. And there are forms of Buddhism that do ultimately, affirm some truth within each human being, that there is a core. Yeah, that there are several, major Buddhist sutras that revolve around this as well. So Anatman is not necessarily the only, view of the Buddhists. And we don't even know whether this is the original view that Buddha himself preached. It is very possible that Buddha himself did not pass any comment on this particular thing. But, some of the Mahayana schools say later that the Buddha explicitly talked about soul. And, yet said that this was an esoteric knowledge that others should not be given, because they will, get caught in the romanticism of past lives and things like that.
And as Buddhism progressed, that's why it got so absorbed in the natural culture of India or natural philosophy of the Vedanta. Because it converged towards it.
Yeah, perhaps. It's unclear exactly what happened, but possibly.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, let's
read. Saroja, do you want to read? You there, Saroja? Okay, we hear you now.
Okay. As I met, but you find a great difference. But the old theories affirm the modern is rebirth as part of the universal process. Modern thought starts from the physical body as the basis of our existence and recognizes the reality of no other world except in the material universe. What it sees here is a mental consciousness associated with the life of the body, giving in its birth no sign of previous individual existence and leaving in its end no sign of subsequent individual existence. What was before? Before birth is a material energy with its seed of life, or at best an energy of life force, which persists in the seed transmitted by the parents and gives, by its mysterious infusion of past developments into the trifling vehicle, a particular mental and physical stamp to the new individual mind and body thus strangely created. What remains after death is the same material energy or life force persisting in the seed transmitted to the children and active for the further development of the mental and physical life carried with it. Nothing is left of us except what we transmit to others, or what the energy which shaped the individual by its pre-existent and its surrounding action, by birth and by environment, may take as the result of his life and works into its subsequent action. Whatever may help by chance or by physical law to build the mental and vital constituents and environment of the other individuals, that alone can have any survival. Behind both the mental and physical phenomena, there is perhaps a universal life of which we are individualized, evolutionary, and phenomenal becomings. This universal life creates a real world and real beings. But the consciousness, personality, conscious personality in these beings is not, or at least it need not be, the sign or the shape of consciousness of an eternal, nor even of the persistent soul or supraphysical person. There is nothing in this formula of existence compelling us to believe in a psychic entity that outlasts the death of the body. There is here no reason and little room for the admission of rebirth as a part of scheme of things.
So here he is developing further the same idea, and you know, it is Sri Aurobindo's method to proceed in a spiraline form. It's also his educational method, for that matter, where he introduces in a nutshell a certain idea and then draws out the various constituents and expands on them. And so here he's talking about the difference between the theories that he has introduced and showing the fact that historicality also has something to play in it. That the older theories of, say, Advaita or Buddhism do affirm a rebirth, though they have no real need for it, and that's what he's going to come to later. But that the later inconscient theories, theories based on the inconscience, which, for example, modern theories based on science are all about, you know, show actually little regard for the existence of soul. So in some way, they're more, in some sense, logical, that if they don't have any need for the soul, there is no need to posit rebirth. And that's what he's talking about in this paragraph, where he is speaking about genetics as the only sort of determinant of characteristics of the past and passed on into the progeny for the future. So whatever persistence of consciousness we may find is restricted to a chain of different bodies that are linked to genetic transmission. There's no need to believe in a psychic entity either in one life or in a succession of lives.
I totally agree with you. This is, while we were reading the paragraph, I also noticed that he really develops the full paksha aspect very, very clearly. And I think in that sense, you know, he is very traditional with respect to how the dialogue or the debates were held in India.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because in a way, yes, Sri Aurobindo is following a Vedantic method. He's following a Vedantic method in his elaboration of his darshan. In a way, he is engaging with the entire tradition of Western philosophy, but from the standpoint of an Indian methodology.
Right.
Philosophy needed the concept of rebirth. Why did they posit? But they often regarded the goal of life to be getting out of the cycle of rebirth. Again and again, you see this idea of moksha as something to come out of the cycle of rebirth. But again, it says that there is no reason to posit the idea of rebirth itself. Why did, isn't it contradictory? Like, why did they posit and why didn't? I didn't understand that thing at all.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you're quite right. It is contradictory. And that's what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out. What he's essentially pointing out is that, you know, that there must be independent bases for these things. And ultimately, these independent bases are resting in Vedanta. You see, you know, whatever we are talking about, whether it's Buddhism or whether it's Advaita Vedanta, they're proceeding along certain lines of argument, but they are also taking their bases from Vedanta. And basis of rebirth is there in Vedanta. So they don't deny that basis. Also, there is the you know, the kind of accumulated evidence of spiritual experience itself. The fact that there is rebirth is attested to by innumerable sort of records of yogis. And so that these older theories, which are basing themselves on a tradition of yoga, cannot deny that there is a rebirth, both because of its Vedantic foundation and because of the accumulation of spiritual experience. But what they make of it is contradictory. And that it is contradictory is what he's pointing out over here. He's setting them up for showing this contradiction, which he will try to overcome.
Somewhat unrelated question, which maybe related, I don't know. When you look at the Puranas, we have the tradition of, we have the concept of avatars, right? Rama, Krishna. Like, can we kind of think of them as rebirths of Vishnu? Incarnations and rebirths.
Yeah.
What is the, is there a relation between these two?
There is a relation. Actually, there is a relation. But there is also essential difference. Essential difference is that what we talk about rebirth, as he'll point out over here, it is connected to the theory of evolution of consciousness. In other words, that the psychic being evolves and its evolution is tied to the evolution of the nature. Nature not just forms as in the Western theory, but nature itself, that is in terms of the forces of matter, life and mind that form the prakriti or vehicle of the psychic being, of the soul. Like Krishna says to Arjuna in the Gita, he says the difference between you and me is that I remember all my past births, but you don't. See, that's a very important phrase or line there, which refers to the progress in the ignorance of the human soul. But the choice of the avatar in knowledge to enter into different births. So it is not really an evolution that is going on in terms of the avatar, but it is an intervention in an evolutionary process. Therefore, there is the sense of avatars that have a certain kind of a evolutionary appearance. You see, so that is the relationship. But avatar does not evolve in the same way that human souls evolve, following the succession of nature's process.
It is to show.
Now, if you remember, he says, I press my srijamyaham. He says, I press myself into nature. I cast myself through nature into this birth. So he uses nature. Avatar is the Supreme Purushottama using nature to enter into birth. While human souls are a subject to nature in coming to birth.
So, kind of continuation of somewhat of related question is, traditional texts talk about way to burn all the karma is by jnana, that is jnanagni karma dagdhanam. That is the typically jnana is used as a instrument to burn up karma, so to get out of the cycle of birth. That is the thought process we come across. So the real meaning of, can we think of real meaning of that as instead of involuntarily coming into birth, it is by choice one can enter into the evolution. That is the real meaning of that burning up of the karma. Can we think of it that way?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That is exactly what it comes to, boils down to. Even the Vedantic or Upanishadic emphasis on becoming free from the cycles of rebirth. You have to understand the difference between becoming free from the cycles of rebirth and escaping the cycles of rebirth, or not coming back into rebirth. Becoming free from the cycles of rebirth means having the choice to be reborn or not to be reborn. While as against either being forced to be reborn or being forced not to be reborn. You see, there's a place where Sri Aurobindo says, God is not, I'm forgetting the exact aphorism, but it's something to the effect that God is free beyond, you know, being forced to, you know, sort of be bound. God is free to be bound, in other words. His freedom is so great that he can allow himself to be bound and still remain free. Yeah, I think he says God is not bound by his freedom. I mean, freedom itself can be a binding. You know, if you have to get out of the cycle of rebirth, that is a binding of the opposite kind as having to get into rebirth.
Yeah, it's paradoxical, but it is.
From Gita as also Sveteshwar Upanishad. Both places he says if something is born, it has to death. Certain is death, that is which is born, and certain is the birth, that which is dies. And again, in the third para, where he talks about matter on page 774, matter is eternal, for from matter all beings are born, and by matter all beings exist, and to matter all beings depart and return. So he's kind of accepting that from matter we are all the beings are born, and they have to return again. So I'm a little confused now. Now he's saying rebirth is not necessary, and it's only for genetic reasons. So what is the connection here?
No, you see, okay, let's go back. And you see, the first thing that you quoted, which is from the Gita, that which doesn't have any, what does he say over there? That which is born must die, and that which is, to be born is necessary that one will die, and to die, it means that he will be born again. Is that what you say?
No, certain
is death of that which is born, and certain is the birth. Exactly, that's what he's saying. So now that he's talking about forms. He's talking about whatever is subject to the processes of nature. Okay? That which is born and that which dies. Now, the point that Sri Aurobindo is getting to is that the soul is not born, nor does it die. And all these theories that he has introduced, including the one that you read from that paragraph 3, are not really being able to explain the reality of the soul. This is the point he's making. Neither that thing about matter being the beginning and matter being the end, everything coming from matter and going back to matter, nor the thing about Advaita where, you know, everything is coming out of a superconscience and disappearing into a superconscience, can explain the reality of the soul, which is not subject to the processes of birth and death. It is not born, and neither does it die. And this also is there in the Gita, right in the beginning. One of the first arguments that Krishna makes to Arjuna is that the soul is unborn, and it never dies, you see. So that which is born must die, and that which dies must have a birth, refers to only the nature part of our being. does not refer to the soul.
So soul is always there, constant, or we lose the soul? Because what I'm trying to understand here, there is no concept of rebirth. What happens to the soul? It gets salvation, or it's united with the divine?
No, you know, the no concept of soul, when you're talking about the rebirth in what we are discussing right now, he's just pointing out that the theory of rebirth is not necessary to a spiritual philosophy that believes that the soul has a birth and a death. He's not saying that that is the truth of things. He's not saying that rebirth is not real. He is saying that rebirth is real, but the philosophies that believe that the soul is born and dies, or the soul is you know, appears out of some kind of substance, universal substance, and disappears into it, have a contradiction within them. That's all he's saying.
Thank you.
Debashish, Mahesh, Debashish.
Hi, Mahesh.
Long time, I just wanted to ask you, you know, I think we're in a fair amount of agreement, you know, and it's a fairly abstract idea, but the thing that I'm not able to fully get a grasp of is the different worlds that are possible to inhabit. I mean, the possibility of returning back and forth, etc., being somewhat well established and so on. Is there a reasonable description of the different planes where, even if you don't return to the same, you know, planet, as to where else one might inhabit? Because the clarity of what happens in the beyond is still missing. It's all about the possibilities and why the system exists, etc. But the actual description of where one goes in the intermediary stages and where else one might move beyond, even though you're reborn, I guess essentially there's a the immortality that's transformed in various stages is what he's referring to as rebirths. It doesn't have to be the same type of life. So I'm wondering if you can touch on the sort of spatial, I mean, it's supposed to be beyond space and time, but there must be some other sort of physical or locational things associated with other planes. I'm just wondering whether it's all just in consciousness or whether there are real places that are there, other worlds.
Mahesh, actually, he has not yet dealt with that issue as yet. But you see, that is an important argument that you will take up later. Because you see, talking about different conceptions of the soul and of the afterlife, as you see, he has touched upon the Judeo-Christian or the Abrahamic idea of a beginning and no end. Later, he will touch on the Greek idea of transmigration. The idea of transmigration is that we move from body to body. There is no existence of the soul outside of the earth. So we and then there is, of course, Buddhistic ideas, as in the Jatakas, of existence of some kind of consciousness which moves from, you know, one creature to another, but with no progression to it. See, so these are ideas that restrict the human being to, or the human soul, even if we admit a human soul, restrict it to only the life on the earth. But Sri Aurobindo is going to show us, or talk about, or argue his way into showing that no, it must also have lives outside of this earth. Now, that is what the question that you were bringing up. But eventually, it must come back into this world. So, there are, one may say, there is the process of birth, life on earth, death, then a process outside of the earth, and then a process back or a rebirth into the world, into this world. And the reason why he is going to talk about this world is why is rebirth necessary at all? That argument he has not made at all as yet. So until he goes through that argument, it is not possible to answer your question. But all I can say at this point is that yes, there is an existence outside of this earth in worlds beyond, but those worlds cannot be thought of in the physical way because they are not physical worlds. These are non-physical worlds, and therefore their realities, though objective enough, are not like the hard objectivity of matter. They are forces and qualities that can have a variety of appearances depending on who is doing the observing and what is manifesting itself there. But they have universal characteristics, and Sri Aurobindo describes these in fairly great detail in Savitri.
Mm.
Oh, wow. It's great. Thank you, David. That gives great clarity on the fact that his sort of finality is that the worlds are planes of consciousness, not necessarily real planes. But I was trying to converge it with the possible scientific
explanations. They are real planes, Mahesh. They are real planes, but they are not physical planes.
Yeah, but it does not. The thing is, I'm still curious whether we'll find life elsewhere in other parts of the universe that might be a connected place for continuity, where you can be, you know, possibly in another, solar system, in another form for another life. And I don't know that we can completely exclude that. But it appears that so far that's not been the main track that they've taken, that it's mostly a non-physical continuity that they've meant.
Yeah, now that issue, of course, then also there's a question of forms and of rebirth being connected to evolution. And the fact that, as the argument he'll make is that we don't jump from species to species and being to being, but the soul has taken on a certain project of evolution. And therefore, whether there are beings with alien bodies in Mars or in some other place, and from this life we continue our evolution there or not, it doesn't sort of jive with his theory of evolution where the human consciousness is developing towards the Superman. If that is there, that would be another form of consciousness, more likely an archetypal consciousness, not an evolutionary consciousness. So he has talked about, just as he's talking about, the appearance of consciousness in forms and their disappearance as a possibility, which does not need rebirth. Such kinds of possibilities are also there in other planets. But if there is to be rebirth, then there has to be not only a beginning and a continuity of consciousness through various lives, whatever those lives are, but lives which themselves show some continuity and progress in nature. That's the reason why he will argue for a consciousness of the soul, which is interminable, but which nevertheless inhabits a succession of forms that are evolutionary.
Debashish, I wanted to ask, he mentions the soul as, he said, how can the soul, if it doesn't have an end, have a beginning? It can't have a beginning. But I'm not sure about, why couldn't it have a beginning? I guess I just don't understand that, follow that.
Yeah, he's saying that because he basically, beginnings and ends belong to the processes of nature. They belong to the processes of time.
Okay.
And that which doesn't have an end already is outside of the processes of time. And in that, it's again, we were talking about the paradox of looking at reality either as a continuity or as a quantum. In other words, something, particular, something bound by, you know, on the one hand in time by birth, and on the other hand, at the other end by death. So temporal realities having, you know, beginnings are, however large they may be in time, also constrained by ends. But realities that have no beginning, or either of no beginning or no end, belong to that domain outside of time. Therefore, they follow that other law, beginningless and endless. That which enters time may show continuity. In other words, you see, the question you raised is a very important one, because it relates to the notion of a divine body. One may say that if we are talking about, or if Sri Aurobindo is talking about, a supramental body, and remember, you know, many people in the ashram were thinking or waiting for Sri Aurobindo or the mother themselves to become supramental in the body. So the idea existed that either or both of them will live immortally, right? So that would be possible, you know, example of somebody who had a birth but who doesn't have a death. Am I right? So, you know, the notion exists, but, you know, he will himself, you know, articulate that notion. We've talked about this several times. You know, he re-articulates that notion in the first chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga, where he says the condition of a physical immortality is to be perpetually reborn in time. In other words, that immortal body is being inhabited by a being who's obeying the law of births and deaths, consciously coming into birth and consciously dying, and doing so in a continuous manner, so that one doesn't observe any birth and death, but nevertheless the soul is inhabiting totally new bodies from moment to moment. That is the condition of a physical immortality.
And then, I wanted to, I don't know if we're running out of time or what, but there's this thing, I don't know, I heard in India about yogins being reborn, say, as elephants. I know that might sound kind of weird, but when I was in Madurai, and I saw that temple elephant they had, I don't know, I just wondered about that. You know,
with that. That, Vince, is absolutely not impossible, but that doesn't, you know, that you see, like, you know, the mother says a yogi may
right.
flout the laws of nature, you see.
Yes.
So a yogin may be free enough to assume the kind of animal body by choice, you see. But that is not the evolutionary process.
Correct.
See, that can be done through yogic power, yoga siddhi. See, and people have done it. No.
Oh.
So that is a little different.
Okay.
Debashita, Nachiketa's question to Yama in the Kathopanishad is like that, right? Pretty much what Mahesh was asking. What happens to a person after he dies? Where does he go?
Yeah, he asks that. And also his question pertains to exactly what we are talking about. What gives us temporal immortality? You see, that he persists until he gets an answer to that. And Yama ultimately tells him about the psychic being.
Devashishta, question about, there is a kind of an understanding that, okay, every moment to moment, we are in a way dying and being reborn. That is moment to moment. Or also, if we were to take a larger quanta of time, every day when we change various states of consciousness, basically sleep, or if we were to just take two states of sleep and being awake, these two are also like experiencing death and rebirth at an individual level. So, like, if we were to understand the concept of rebirth to be primarily to evolve, evolution or a play, so if we were to understand and kind of fix our meditation, what would be a good way to meditate on this concept of rebirth and day-to-day sadhana?
That's actually a very profound question. And in fact, you know, what you said just now is exactly what Sri Aurobindo is talking about in as the condition of a physical immortality, and the mother talks about it very beautifully at one place, where she's saying that, as a matter of fact, if your consciousness united with the divine's in its integrality, you would see that the whole world is being born and dying at every moment and being reborn. And you would have the choice of that rebirth. In other words, you would be the person bringing it to birth and seeing it die. See, so that particular process in that moment of birth is a creative moment. It's creative in the originary sense. That is, it gives creation, but it gives it through the power of creativity. So that person who is aware that each moment is a moment of psychic creativity is living that kind of life, may not be extended fully into the material, but there is the constant sense that there is the openness to grace, which is the transcendent being born in every moment. So that openness presumes that there is a certain, only through the clearance of karma that can be done. All the preconceptions, all the preconditions, if there is a full surrender of the being to the knowledge that, you know, each moment is a creative birth and an immediate death, then that is the condition of the surrendered, you know, process of perpetual miracle. Each moment is just a miracle of the mother. It exists because she makes it exist. It manifests because she makes it manifest. And your own creative power is she who in you is making that happen. You are identified with that and share in the delight of that. So that is the you know, legacy of surrender, with that knowledge that each moment is a creation and a dissolution by the Divine Mother.
Devashish, your explanation is very beautiful. I don't remember where I read this, but reading something about surrender, complete surrender, there it talks exactly something in similar lines, like you have to think you're not doing anything. Divine is doing through you. Like even if you eat food, you're not eating. Divine is eating through you. That's what I just wanted to share.
Yeah. Shall we come to an end for today?
Yeah. We can end with a short meditation.